This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, many of the everyday items we own and use have become technologically so advanced in recent years. Everything from fridges with the internet to what our mobile phones can do, even cars and tractors. But our ability to repair them has become harder and in many cases pretty much impossible. Many companies now insist that only the manufacturer is able to carry out those repairs. But maybe that's all about to change. The Productivity Commission is recommending that the federal government amend laws to give us, the consumers, more rights. The commission has released a right to repair report. It was actually released late last year, but it got a little bit buried in all of the chaos of Christmas and COVID. It sets out a raft of recommendations. It includes everything, changes from consumer and intellectual copyright laws. But the other thing that's happening is that there's a generational shift in thinking about the so-called latest model. Many young people are now pushing back at big companies like Apple, who build obsolescence into their products, and they're demanding that they self-repair. So maybe the days of lining up and sometimes even overnight for the latest phone model and the latest release of things are now something of the past. So do you want to have the right to repair something? From farm equipment, toasters, to your mobile phone, what do you want to be able to fix?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria,
this is The Conversation Hour.
From farm equipment, toasters, to your mobile phone, why is it just so difficult to be able to repair anything? Mark Harvey is an employee at J&T Electrical Appliances. He's in Ashburton. Mark, this is what you deal with every day, day in, day out, trying to repair things. What are people bringing into repair that you simply can't?
Well, as you mentioned, toasters, kettles, we do mostly smaller appliances, but we're doing, I mean, we have a lot of stuff we can repair, coffee machines, mixers, that sort of thing. So there's a whole raft of things that come through that we have a look at, and you know, a lot of them can't be repaired. They don't have spare parts available. It's just just a lot of stuff.
It must be frustrating. I know years ago trying to get a toaster fixed and I pretty much got laughed out of the shop and was told just to buy a new one. I mean, everything from toasters to other appliances. Are people getting frustrated? I mean, we sort of understand now that we have been living for some time and the problems that it's caused, living in a throwaway culture, and people want to change that. So how do your customers feel when they come in and you say you can't fix it?
Well, they're not happy. There's a lot of people that do come in and specifically say, look, I want to get this repaired. They're happy with the unit. They've had a long life out of it, and they actually want to get it fixed. They don't want to have to buy the newest model. They prefer to. They don't want to get things put into landfill, basically, and they're trying their best to stamp that out. But unfortunately, if you can't get the parts, there's nothing you can do.
Has it got harder over the years? How long have you been in this industry?
I've been working here for nearly 30 years. And yes, when I first started, yes, we were fixing kettles, elements in kettles, toasters, all those smaller sorts of things. Yes, slowly, it's just whittled down. And now it seems that anything that's under, you know, I was having this discussion this morning. Anything under, say, a couple of $100s is just deemed to be a throwaway item, I guess.
We're going to speak to the Productivity Commission in just a moment about some of the changes that they want to see happen. Do you ever think, you know, we don't want to sort of always hark back to the days of old and things were better and whatnot, but there surely has to be somewhere in the middle, don't you think, where we can start to repair things?
I do. I think there should be. If manufacturers made things with that longevity in mind that you can repair something, and of course that's going to give people confidence when they go to buy a new product, they can say, hey, I had this particular thing for however long, you know, 10 years, I won't get it repaired because it's a bit you know, long in the tooth now, but I will buy that same product again, knowing full well that I can get it repaired and get another 10 years or whatever time frame out of it. And that'll give them sort of confidence in that.
Mark, thanks so much for your time.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Good on you. That's Mark Harvey. He's an employee at J&T Electrical Appliances, which is in Ashburton. I can remember when our washing machine finally kind of went kaput and broke, and I was shocked because, you know, we'd only had it for 15 years. And I was used to growing up in an environment where your family not only, maybe you didn't even buy a washing machine, it was handed down to you and then it just kept going and going and going. And now when you got to get something fixed, like a dishwasher or whatever it may be, they'll turn to you and say, oh, geez, you're lucky to get 5 years out of it. Well done. I mean, those things should be lasting longer. Adrian's in Clifton Hill. Adrian, welcome. What did you want to say?
Just an example of a successful repair. I bought a $150 portable speaker, like a really large one you can use to address crowds and stuff. And I plugged it into an old generator and shorted it out somehow. And fortunately, I was really lucky that one of my friends is into electronics as a hobby. And he said, look, I'll repair it for you. It was a single 12-cent resistor that had burnt out. And if I didn't have him, I would have thrown out a $150 item and replaced it with a brand new one. So,
yeah. And it's like, being able to do that.
Where are the people who do the repairs? They've gone.
Absolutely. There's not those repair shops. There used to be one in every sort of high street and now they're few and far between. Adrian, thank you so much. What changes are being held up by the Productivity Commission? What do they want to see changed? Julie Abramson is from the Productivity Commission. Julie, this is something that you released towards the end of the year and it sort of did get a little bit buried with Christmas and COVID. People want to hold on to things now, but it's just so tricky when it comes to obsolescence being built in, some of the rules and regulations around manufacturers and what they say you can and can't repair. What do you want to see changed?
Well, we asked if consumers could get their products repaired at a competitive price at the repairer of their choice. And as your callers have highlighted, and you've highlighted yourself, we found that there were unnecessary barriers in the way. And so we proposed a package of reforms to make this easier.
So what were some of the top, say, the top three reforms?
Well, one of the most interesting things is when you were talking about the washing machine, most products now come with embedded software. And one of the problems for consumers now is getting updates for that software, and the law's been left a bit behind. So we would like a consumer guarantee in the law about the ability to get reasonable software updates for a reasonable period of time. The other issue is that consumers, even when they have the rights, find them very hard to actually do something about it. And we would like the states and territories to look at some more ways where people could have conciliation or mediation or some sort of dispute resolution which doesn't involve courts so that they could put their case to manufacturers. The other thing that we also were very interested in is the ACCC doesn't actually have the power to fine a manufacturer or a supplier if they just refuse to honour the guarantee, and we'd like to see that remedied.
I wonder how much power the ACCC would have. I know there's been a lot of frustration at the moment at the lack of control the ACCC has when it comes to pricing of RAT tests, and there was comparisons to petrol prices and the ACCC was supposed to step in there, and how much regulation do we have? Putting that forward, how much of a guarantee does that give us as consumers?
Well, one of the interesting things is that the ACCC, as you've seen lately, can make some public statements about things. And we do think also, though, that it should be supplemented by what we've called a super complaint. And that would allow consumer groups to get information from a whole range of consumers and then put that to the ACCC and ask them to look at that quite closely and give them a time frame for doing that. So that's taking sort of the intelligence out there in the marketplace and putting it squarely before the regulator.
Julie, stay with us. Walter's called from Sunbury. Walter, what did you want to say?
I was just going to touch on the way that they actually design things like white good gears and components that go into a lot of the things that end up in landfill these days.
And so what do you think, that obsolescence is built in?
Absolutely. So I'm a manufacturing engineer myself, and basically through studies and stuff, they they can predict the service life of different things. And so, as an example, a washing machine, they historically used to use steel gears for the drive mechanisms. And nowadays they use nylon, and they play with the density of the nylon so that they estimate, you know, there's an expectation to do 10 loads of 8 kilos per week. And then they play with the density of the nylon so that they know that it will last 5 years. And they have a thing called an L10 life of components. And the L10 life is where they know after a certain amount of use that 10% of the components will fail, and they design and develop products so that at the end of the warranty period, 10% would have failed, or in theory, it's a theory anyway, so that after that, that is a very large cascade, and after the warranty period is expired, you then go from 10% failure within the next year, you might end up with 50% failure.
That's outrageous. I mean, that's using products that you know are going to fail and building in an end of life. Stay with us, Walter, because, Julie, how commonplace is it, you know, to know that even materials are being changed that won't last as long?
Well, one of the things that we decided was that we could do something practically about that, and that was giving consumers more information at the point of purchase. And we were very interested in a repairability index. So that sort of touches on the things that your callers have talked about. Consumers would get information about, can my product be repaired? How long would the spare parts be available for? Can I get the diagnostics to make my product work? And we think that that would be a really good step in driving some behaviour amongst manufacturers.
Walter, can I ask you another question? Because when we look at, let's use the washing machine as an example, okay? So say the washing machine my grandmother used is very different to the washing machine I use now when it comes to electronics, when it comes to the computers that are running these things. Has that got a lot to do with it? They simply don't last as long because there's little mini computers in these as opposed to something being more hands-on and more self-generated.
I don't believe the electronics is the point of failure. Most typically. So I'd say perhaps the user interface is not made as robustly, and so things tend to break, like, you know, switches and handles and components that go into the user interface. But that's also a known quantity that at the end of the day, the product isn't going to be like previously. A washing machine could have been used for 20, 30 years. You will never, ever find a product that these days a washing machine will go that length of time, because they just don't make it like they just make things in a way that is designed to fail so that they can sell you something again in 5 years' time. It's just a design principle. There's no money in selling you something that's going to last you 20 years.
Walter, I'm so glad you rang in. Thanks so much.
No problem at all.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, my name's Rochelle Hunt, and before the press conference we were talking about the Productivity Commission recommendations to government to give us the right to repair things. Everything from farming equipment, we'll speak to a farmer in just a moment, through to our toasters, our washing machines, our VCRs, yes, people are still using VCRs. I've got texts to prove it. But we want to be able to fix things, you know, that obsolescence shouldn't be built into those white goods, those big purchases that we make. This text, here we go, in the late 80s, I bought a VCR. It cost me $900. Wow, back in the 80s, that's a lot of money. But, Rochelle, it's still working today. The DVD player isn't, and it cost me $40. So if you want things to last, you have to pay more for them. That's from Louise. And this is a really good point that's come in on text as well. The cost of the repair is often what makes the repair prohibitive. The difference between repairing my coffee machine and buying a new one with a longer warranty made the extra $150 for the new machine a little bit of a no-brainer. And this, we've been through 5 washing machines in 7 years and 4 dishwashers. We're a family of eight. We do about 10 loads of washing each week, and the dishwasher is put on at least twice a day. We've been told it's not age, but it's wearing out. We've figured it out, and basically it's costing us $1 a go. Julie Abramson is the Commissioner at the Productivity Commission. Julie, I've got text after text. I've got plenty of calls as well. People really are passionate about fixing things, and they're really upset with how long things last. What's the chance of some of these changes that you've put forward actually becoming a reality, do you think?
Well, these are really matters for government to make decisions about, but it's obviously a cause of community concern, and we believe that our package of reforms is quite a practical way of dealing with some of the issues, because it's really not just one issue. And if I could highlight something you spoke about before, one of the issues is also about the schematics or the diagnostic tools that are available. And even if you want to repair a product, you can't actually get behind that code. And we'd like to see some reforms to Australian copyright law so that you'd be protected if you were doing that type of thing for repair purposes.
That even comes into cars as well. I mean, how many of us have a car, you know, it's a certain brand, you want to take it to your local repair shop or whatever it may be, smash repair shop, and they say, look, sorry, mate, I can't touch that because I don't have the license to be able to work under, you know, whatever it is, Mazda, Peugeot, you name it, that we're even sort of strangleholded a little bit when it comes to being able to get our car serviced where we want to.
Well, that's actually improving for consumers because the federal government has put in a scheme which will require car manufacturers to provide independent repairers, which you've just talked about, with paid access to diagnostic service and repair information. And as we were talking before about farmers, we'd like to see a similar scheme for farmers.
Well, let's actually go to a farmer now. Stay with us, Julie. But Ash Fraser, he's from the Victorian Farmers Federation. He's the Greens Group President and a farmer himself. Ash, this is something that farmers have been fighting for a long time, to be able to actually fix some of the agricultural machinery that you use on a daily basis. Just tell us a little bit about how frustrating it is.
Yeah, thanks, Rochelle. It's been incredibly frustrating over the years. I mean, we've got machinery now that's largely driven by electronics, and the technology and so forth that's there. We don't have access to the codes and so forth and to be able to reset those. And that's vitally important for us.
So when you say reset codes, is this when something breaks down, and what are you trying to fix on the fly there?
So essentially what might happen is you might get a sensor might get covered in dust or be contaminated somehow within the machine, and that'll throw a fault code, which can then derate the engine and render the machine useless. And inevitably what happens is you wait hours for a technician to come out. They plug the computer in and go, it's tripped this fault code. We're not sure why. We'll just reset it. And then they go on their way. And then later on that night, it happens again.
Blood is boiling just listening to this, because how often, I mean, talking about depending on what you're farming, dust would get onto equipment all the time.
Yeah, and it can be, you know, something like when you're looking at some of these sensors, they've got time parameters. And if something's a millisecond out on reading its reaching its, you know, operating temperature or time or something like that, then it'll trip the fault code. And if the fault code is connected with an engine derate system, then it just derates the engine and machine.
So how much time do you lose? How much valuable working time do you lose, Ash, as a result of this?
Oh, well, you can lose hours, you can lose days, depending on the access and how busy the repair people are. But this is where, as farmers, we often don't have access to that third-party repair person. And the Productivity Commission report was pretty clear in that, you know, 71% of farmers would use a third-party repair person if they had access to them.
So that would just make it quicker. There would be someone locally that you could call. They would have access to that code. If you were pretty handy yourself, and let's face facts, most farmers are, if you had access to that code yourself, is it something that you could self-repair? Because we know that there's a huge push in self-repair at the moment as well.
Yeah, 100%. And that's, and you're right, most farmers like ourselves are pretty savvy on that front. We've got little dongles that you can plug into the computers on passenger vehicles with an app on your phone that enables you to reset those codes. And so if you can reset that on the fly, you've lost minutes. And then if the fault persists, then you can get hold of your technician. The technician can go, oh yeah, okay, well you've reset that. Like, clearly there's a fault with that sensor. And their first visit out, they come out with the new sensor, fit it, and away you go.
How dominated are you by one or two companies as well, without naming names? Is this something where you see that there is a monopoly by only a handful of companies, and then basically they can just write their own rules?
That's exactly it. And it depends on what region you're in as to which one of those manufacturers is the strongest in that area. And so you're largely beholden to that. But it was interesting that the report also outlined that where owners align themselves directly with the authorised dealers, that they were four times more likely to experience a delay that cost them more than $25,000.
Gosh. Hey, Ash, stay with us because Julie Abramson from the Commission is still with us as well. Julie, that's crazy. I mean, Ash kind of spells that out. Something has to change. And I know that farming equipment was very high at the list of some of the recommendations by the Commission. This is something that needs to be addressed.
Well, certainly we heard exactly what, the Farmers Federation said to us. Of course, we talked to the manufacturers and suppliers as well, and that's why we think that the scheme that's very similar to the motor vehicle scheme that's already been legislated would really put some power back into the hands of the farmers.
What sort of time frame, Julie, are you expecting changes to occur?
Well, one of the things that's happening at the moment is, partly because of some of the overseas developments in the United States, is the manufacturers are working on processes to make things more available to farmers and independent repairers. But we'd really like the design process for such a scheme to start by the end of 2022.
Ash, I hope this changes for you, because the last thing you need to do with everything else that's happening at the moment is have some kind of little malfunction happen with the computer. And we know the simple turn on and off doesn't always work when it comes to farming equipment. What do you actually grow? What do you farm yourself?
No, we're a cropping operation, so 30% wheat, 30% canola, and 40% range of other things. Yep.
And how's it all going for you? We know that it's been a really tricky year in terms of being able to find staff, supply issues, you name it.
Yeah, it's been a challenging year. Although, fortunately, yields this year were okay, and we're fairly happy with how the year turned out for us. There's a lot of people out there that have not fared so well, whether it be through frosting or too much rain over harvest, and issues with shot and sprung wheat and quality and so forth. But it's been not too bad. But I guess when we go back to this right to repair, it's when you're looking at 69% of the machinery that are on farmers' properties costs more than $100,000. Yeah. And I would beg to say that with the cost of a header now pushing $1 million, this is really serious. And when these machines they're run essentially by computers, we've got to be able to get the productivity out of these machines, and that means getting repairs in a timely manner. So this is really important.
Ash, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
That's Ash Fraser. He's the VFF Grains Group President and a farmer himself. Julie Abramson is with you from the Productivity Commission. Let's have a chat with Ken. He's in Hyatt. Ken, welcome to the conversation now. What did you want to say?
Oh, look, thanks, Rochelle. You happened to listen to the segment off the cuff, but I wanted to pick up on a couple of points. Firstly, responsibility for repairs done, and particularly in the context of complex products instead of very simple things, where safety is so important. And I'm talking about a lot of household systems, which may be gas or refrigerant or electricity-based, and there is a real need to recognise the importance of licensing and training of repairers to do any such work. Otherwise, everyone is at risk. And, you know, I have done work for manufacturers where, you know, they are held responsible for work done by other people who have not followed any instructions and put the customer, the consumer, in danger because of their unsafe.
Ken, it's a really good point too, because the last thing I guess we're suggesting is that you go and try and work with electronics yourself. I guess, Julie, it's more about giving people the freedom to not have to use a particular licensed dealer, that they can go to someone else local, that they can choose that person to repair it, and that that person has access to whatever the codes may be or to the information that they need in order to fix something. Just finally, Julie, do costs need to come down on repairing things? There's a lot of texts here saying, yeah, to fix stuff is just too expensive, it's actually cheaper to replace.
Well, one of the difficulties is that that's really just a function of the market, and Australia is an importer of many of these products, and you've highlighted that one of the difficulties with repair is it's just not economically sensible in a country like Australia to send your dishwasher from Brisbane, say, to Sydney for repair. But we do believe that our package of reforms would make it easier for consumers to make the choice that clearly they value.
Julie, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Julie Abramson, she's the Commissioner at the Productivity Commission. Danny's in Lake Hume. Danny, welcome to the Conversation Hour. What did you want to say?
My name is Michelle. How are you? I'm a qualified electronics maintenance engineer. Like, I learnt the trade many years ago in the Australian military. And it breaks my heart to see people bring me things to repair. And then I say, right, we need a circuit diagram, a schematic. Trying to get that out of a manufacturer is like trying to get blood from the stone sometimes. And then often the parts are no longer produced or obsolete. So you have to either track them down or find a broken similar item and cannibalise it for parts. And then on some specialised equipment, such as an amplifier, I've just been repairing for a friend, a $2,000 amplifier. It's a simple component that's broken, but all the identifier marks have been scratched off by the manufacturer.
Oh, gosh.
So you don't even know what the part is. And I'd hate to see...
Yes, I mean, that's a beautiful amplifier. It's a beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, it's an old... It's like 20 years old, but we finally managed to find a circuit diagram and manual, and we finally also got the parts. They had to come from the US.
Yeah, it was about having
It was a nightmare.
Yeah, I know. And lots of people are saying the same thing. It takes a lot of work, and there's a lot of actual effort put in from the manufacturers to ensure that we don't have that information. But there is a big shift generationally. Lots of people, you know, don't want the latest item. They don't want to line up overnight because the latest model has come out. They don't want obsolescence to be built into their products. Dr. Kristen Alford is a futurist. She's the Director of Museum of Discovery at the University of South Australia. Kristen, are we seeing a shift here? You know, the days of lining up around the corner for the latest iPhone, are they a thing of the past?
I certainly think we are seeing some changes. And I mean, I think one of the signals where we see changes around fast fashion, for instance. So there's been a lot of, you know, discussion around sort of throwaway fashion. And I notice in the young people that we have contact with, although they might be buying items regularly, they're also sharing and renting. And, you know, there's a lot of shared distribution going on. And then in some circles of young people, there's also a real interest in visible mending. So using, you know, brightly coloured cottons and wools to mend holes in garments that you know, are done in beautiful ways. So I think we are seeing these signals of people saying, I'm looking for more than throwaway. And actually, the environment is a really important concern to me. And I think we certainly see that in that young generation.
When it comes to electronics, if there is enough of a pushback, and especially the Gen Zs, and we'll speak to one in just a moment, that their passion for climate change, and rightly so, is so strong, will we see any kind of change from those big companies like, you know, Apple or Samsung or whoever it may be that are providing our tablets and our phones, to be able to give those products longevity so that we don't have to upgrade, that we don't have to have the latest model, so that it all talks to our other software. I basically had to use one of my smart devices as a doorstop at the moment because it doesn't do anything, but technically it still works, but none of the other things will talk to it. They're like, no, I'm sorry, you're too old, I'm not talking to you anymore. Will that start to change?
Yeah, I mean, I got laughed at when I went back to the Apple store with an old phone saying, would you like to take this back? Just assuming that they would if I had a new one, you know, that there'd be some
to put
way
it in a museum because it's so old.
For recycling or, I don't know, something. I mean, I think the issue that we have is the model of the economy that we use at the moment doesn't take into account any of those externalities like waste or time or any of those things that we might as a community actually value. And so there is a push to think about more circular or regenerative economies that take into account the waste that's generated by a product. At the moment, there's no financial incentive for Apple to take back a phone or to help you repair it. There's more incentive to sell you a new one. But if those externalities are actually considered as part of the pricing and as part of our economic model, then we start to see incentives because it becomes much cheaper to return a phone and repair it for the company, as opposed to putting all of the onus on us. So I think, you know, we might see this change, but it's a very broad system change.
Yeah, it is. I just wonder whether, you know, we'll see smaller groups, smaller organisations and companies start up and create, you know, a new type of phone or whatever it may be that can take that place, that will have all of the elements and that will have the ethos that a lot of people want.
Yeah, and I think we're already starting to see this around Fair Work. So something like a Fairphone, which is you know, has supply chain lines that are free of slavery, for instance, is one example of that. I mean, I also think we're, you know, in other areas we're seeing a drive towards increasing personalisation. And yet the sorts of things that we're talking about today don't allow for any sort of personalization because we're buying a product and then replacing it with a mass manufactured product. So I think there is an opportunity in the market to think about how we might, you know, buy a base model, if you like, and personalize that for ourselves and personalize for that interest. And if we're going to do that, perhaps that then also opens up opportunities to, you know, personalize the repair components of that as well. So I do think there is opportunity for us to rethink the way that we are doing things, and there are opportunities for some of those niche applications.
People are certainly frustrated, so I wouldn't be surprised if it happens. I can't see me doing it anytime, Kristen, but I dare say people are already thinking about it. It's always great to speak with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Kristen Orford, futurist and director of the Museum of Discovery at the University of South Australia. Andrew's in Malvern. Andrew, welcome. What frustrates you when it comes to being able to repair certain things?
Being an older engineer, worked in product manufacturing and things, people sometimes say to me, oh, look, can you help me fix this? I've got the part for it, you know, a power connector on a computer. Well, it takes me longer to do that. It might take me 8 hours because I've never done it before. And sure, the bottle of red from a mate is great, but it's really not economic to do that sort of thing. And I had an experience with a washing machine for 10 years. It stopped working. I pulled it apart, had a look at it, went to a retired electric motor manufacturer and said, am I right in thinking that this washing machine has failed due to the lack of a 20-cent piece of paper that should have been installed in the motor to do that? He said, yes. So this is built-in obsolescence. One of the things that we were told at uni, you've got to put a bit of paper in to stop the vibrations of wearing out your wires and shorting out your motor. No,
that's just something that's
built-in
not in
obsolescence.
There.
Yeah. 10 years gone.
It reminds me, absolutely, it reminds me, Andrew, and I totally forgot about this. My pa could fix anything and everything, and if, you know, in his shed, people from all around the town, we didn't need a repair shop in Trafalgar. You just go visit Arthur Herbs, knock on his door and ask him to fix it, and you say, yeah, I've got a jigger out the back, and out he would go and he'd fix everything and anything, that from roller skates to washing machines, and I just wonder how possible that would be now. Thank you. Michael's called from Keilor Downs. Mike, the car industry is something that frustrates a lot of us when it comes to the right to repair.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I had a dealing with my brother's car because I know quite a bit about electronics and he knows nothing. And, of course, all these cars, they were electronics. So he pulled his battery out of his car and he left it there for I don't know how many months. When he connected the battery out, when he connected the battery up again, he got this radio code on his screen. And, of course, I looked it up, and I didn't know much about it, but I rang up a very reputable person who knew about electronics. Oh, he said, look, just get someone who's got a scan tool, go to a local garage. $50, you know, it'll take about 5 minutes. But my brother said, no, I'm going to go back to the dealer because they're supposed to know. So he went to this major dealer, and he asked them how much will it cost to fix this code, get his car, you know, stereo and everything going. The first one said $250 half a day. The second one said $450 and we have to have the car the whole day. And in the end, all it took was $50 and 5 minutes of a local mechanic's time with my help again. And then he decided, no, I'm going to go back to the dealer and have a go at it. And he said, no, I'm sorry, sir, we are correct. We are the dealers. We know. Mm. He wouldn't listen. I said, we've done it.
Well, we all get frustrated by cars. I mean, I think it's why so many of us run our cars into the ground as well, is that we're just so afraid of how much a service or a part is going to cost us. Michael, thank you. You're on the Conversation Hour. We're talking about the right to repair, things that we want to be able to fix ourselves. The Productivity Commission has put a raft of recommendations into the government to say, here's what needs to change. Some rights need to come back to consumers. There's also a big generational shift in younger people wanting to be able to self-repair. Ashley Fell is the Director of Advisory at McCrindle. When we're talking about Gen Z and consumer habits and some of the biggest concerns that people of your age have, Ashley, is right to repair important?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that does circle back to that whole sustainability mindset and expectation that this very digital, very global, very socially minded generation have. I mean, we know that they've been raised and shaped with this global topic at the forefront of their minds, even the pandemic opening their eyes to, yeah, sustainable practices and holding brands and organisations accountable when they aren't actually performing in that sort of authentic way where they say, yeah, we value sustainability, but then they don't actually act that out. So they're holding them account, and they, a lot of brands and organisations, I think, today are even fearing that sort of cancel culture if they don't among this generation as well.
How do you hold such a big organisation to account, though? I mean, let's face facts. What are you going to do? Just not buy their product? Someone else will take that place?
Yeah, that's right. So I think what we are seeing with this generation is they are being active, and we do need, I guess, as consumers, people to sort of vote with their feet or vote with their wallets if they don't agree with an organisation in terms of, yeah, not buying their products or not engaging with them. But I guess the other thing that this generation has is sort of an empowerment with social media, with online presence, where they can sort of not just, you know, write a negative review, but if they're someone with a big influence online on social media, on TikTok or Instagram, whatever it might be, they can influence other people on a larger scale not to do that and hold brands to that sort of account.
I guess when we think about technology, phones, you know, screens, desktops, whatever it may be, is having the latest model, is that still something that's important to younger people? It used to be a bit embarrassing if you had a really old phone. Is that now almost like a little bit of a badge of honour?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is really interesting because I think what we have with this conversation is a bit of tension between or values around sustainability and longevity and environmental consciousness and holding brands to that account, but then also the practicality or the convenience where if you don't have the latest model, then how quick can your apps or things function or your services or those white goods or your car? So there's that sort of tension, I think, that these generations do hold. But I think we are seeing that shift over time where, yeah, you don't have to have the latest, you don't have to have a fully packed home or wardrobe. It's about sort of, yeah, that badge of honour where you go, no, I'm going to be a bit more minimalist, or I'm going to have something for the longer term that is more sustainable.
How good are you at fixing things? Are you handy when it comes to fixing things, or are you terrible like me?
I'm pretty terrible, but I do have a husband who's pretty good, so maybe that factors in my favour.
Just hand it over. I know, switch it on, switch it off, that's about as good as I can hope for. Or I hand it to my 8-year-old and she's probably got a better chance at fixing it than I do. Ashley, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
Plenty of texts here saying you used to be able to change dying batteries in mobile phones. Now you have to pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Screens have to be heated, glued, melted in order to access the interior. Most people say it's not worth it, the extra cost, and they simply just buy a new one. Even wetsuits here. Now you get free repairs and a replacement wetsuit whilst yours is at the shop. Why can't more companies be like this? I had no idea. Isn't that great? My three-year-old Stick vacuum cleaner is a very well-known brand. It's been had to be sent to Sydney for repair. Only one place in Melbourne that would fix it, and it's closed due to COVID. Issues come when the opening of the backlog of orders. My vacuum will certainly have travelled more than I have in recent times as well. Marita's in Warrnambool. Marita, welcome. What did you want to say?
Just a good news story, Rochelle. My fridge is 53 years old.
Oh, happy birthday to your fridge.
One new door seal and the sides of the shelves come off and I mended them with thin pieces of dowel. I move it out two or three times a year to clean under it. And other times I just swish under it with a damp cloth and a piece of dowel.
53 years going strong. That's impressive, Marita. Absolutely. I'm so glad.
That's neither here nor there.
Thank you. I've got a really old fridge as well. Bits, you know, bits of it may be held together with gaffer tape, but that's okay. It still does the job. And you know how to open it. You know, it's got its own little clicks and you know exactly how to do it. Well, the Right to Repair, the Productivity Commission, if you want to look at some of those recommendations, you can go to their website. We've done very similar shows to this. You can always go to the Conversation Hours podcast, go to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Until then, be safe, be well, take care, be nice to each other, and I'll speak to you tomorrow.